Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I'm your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we will be talking with Ed Wayland, who's a local attorney, about consumer advocacy issues. That's mostly what his practice is. Welcome, Ed.
Thank you very much.
Tell me a little bit about... You're a Charlottesville lawyer, and what you do, as I understand it, is you do consumer advocacy.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about what that means and about how you got into doing that.
In terms of what it means, I represent people who are having problems. It involves issues of credit, where credit card problems, collection problems, problems with... Their credit reports, which is a whole area that people have problems with, and in general, if people have bought something, the other major category, I suppose, that comes to me is people have problems with cars, that they bought a car and it turns out that the car was not as promised.
Right, I see.
They've tried to fix that and. Have run into problems doing that.
Well, what's your background? How'd you get into doing this?
Well, when I first came to Charlottesville many years ago, I came and worked with the Legal Aid Society, what is now called the Legal Aid Justice Center. And even then, I was very interested in consumer work, but there was somebody else on the staff who was been there longer than me who really liked doing that too. So when we divided up the tasks, he got that. And I specialized in public benefits programs. Did for a number of years, specialized in that. Did housing, did some consumer work. Was at Legal Aid off and on for the next probably 15 years. Eventually left and went into private practice. And my interest in consumer law had stayed with me all along. And so I began to do more and more of those kind of cases. And I got very serious about it, and I really enjoy doing it. I think it's interesting. It's a way of helping people who are, in the cases they bring to me, typically not being treated right by some large business organization. Usually the large business organization is not listening to them or trying its best to try to solve these problems. So I get to try to do that.
So let's talk about those large business organizations. Okay. Who's on the other side of these debt cases that you're talking about?
Well, in the debt cases, typically they are companies that are professional debt collectors. The model for this has changed over the last 20 years or so. It used to be that debt collectors were businesses that worked for companies to whom the money was owed, and they would just contract with them to collect the debt for them. Increasingly, the larger companies, banks and others that issue credit cards, have decided they don't want to mess with that. And so what they do is when they have every now and then they'll bundle together the accounts they have that are behind, that are in default, and they just sell them. To companies that buy them, as then that's their business, is that they buy these debts. They typically buy them for very little. The studies have shown something like 3 to 5 cents on the dollar. So if you owe $10,000, what is that? $500 they spend.
All right.
$300 to $500, if I did that right. And then they are entitled to go and try to collect the money, and they own it, so they try to go and collect the money, and they get to keep whatever they can collect.
So if I'm Biggius Bankius, and I have loaned out $1 billion to different people for houses and cars and home equity loans to take a luxury vacation to Cancun or, you know, who knows what, all the things that banks loan money for. Or maybe I issue a credit card from Bankius Biggius, right? And people bought clothes or jewelry or dinner on the credit card over time. I might have thousands, tens of thousands of customers who have borrowed money.
Right.
And then I say, you know, this group of customers over here isn't paying their loan back, right? They're not making their monthly payment. They've not made it over time. It isn't one person. It's, again, thousands of people.
Right.
And I lump all that stuff together, and I say to debt collector, hey, how would you like to have this big chunk of excrement that I I cannot collect on? I cannot get these people to pay me. Is that worth anything to you? And debt collector says, sure, I'll pay you, but I'm not going to pay you the $1 million that is the face value of that debt. I'm going to pay you something much smaller.
Right.
Okay. So,
although one thing I would clarify is that what we're really talking about here is credit card debt.
Okay.
Mortgage debts or the larger secured loans are dealt with in a different way.
Okay.
Mortgage debt, there's the property that's there for security, and so that is dealt with differently.
Credit card debts. That is a
difference. Credit card debts, there's not any security.
There's secured debt and unsecured debt.
Yes.
Explain briefly what the difference is for a layperson to what is a secured debt and what is an unsecured debt.
Okay. Well, a secured debt would be a debt where typically you borrow a specific amount of money and there is property that you own that is put up as collateral, what's called collateral for that debt. And what that means is that if you run into trouble paying it back, then the bank or the lender has the right to take the collateral and sell it.
So, like, if I buy a house,
right,
and I borrow a bunch of money to buy the house,
right,
if I don't pay for my house, the bank that loaned me the money comes in and forecloses on my house.
That's a classic example, and that is what can happen, yes.
So what's an unsecured debt?
Well, an unsecured debt would be a debt where you don't put up anything.
Okay.
And you just do it.
Well, why would the bank loan me money if I'm not going to put up anything?
Well, banks like to issue credit cards because they make a lot of money issuing credit cards. And the fact that a certain percentage of the people with credit cards default and don't pay doesn't mean that the rest of it doesn't work out very well for them.
Right. So on the whole, if you look at the spread across all of their credit card customers, they might not make the 18% per annum that is the interest rate on everything, but when you figure out X percentage of people are going to default, maybe they make 10% or 15%.
Mm-hmm.
But it still ends up being a lot of money because there's a lot of credit cards issued.
Right.
Okay, so an unsecured debt is I take my Visa card and I go out to dinner.
And I'll say just to follow that up a little bit on that, you'll notice that the banks routinely make it easy for you to pay less than the full amount that is due every month.
Now, why would they do that? Is that a kind gesture on their part? They want to, make sure that
I'm sure they would regard it
as
kind, but also it means that you then owe interest on the balance.
So the longer I carry this credit card debt, the more interest I pay on it.
Yes.
Which is true also of my house, right? If I just make a big principal payment toward the mortgage, in the end, I save a lot more than that amount of money on the interest.
True. That's true.
But on a credit card debt, there's no thing that underlies it that they can come back and take. And you carry this debt. I think it's called revolving debt. Is that right? Or revolving credit?
Well, that might be a slightly different term.
Okay.
It's just ongoing. I mean, it's a debt that you owe. It's money that you've borrowed. I mean, in fact, when you use a credit card, I mean, these days, credit cards are used everywhere by almost everyone to buy everything.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't sometimes think about the fact that it's not really money you're spending when you do that.
Right.
You are, in fact, when you buy, the dinner or whatever, you are, in effect, borrowing the money to pay for that from your bank.
I went to Starbucks last week,
and
I whipped out my Bank of America card, and I bought a latte and I think an apple fritter.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the bank is going to have a hard time repossessing that latte from me.
And that's not the deal. The deal is not that they get to repossess anything. They don't have a security interest in any specific piece of property. It's simply your promise to pay.
Let's say I paid $7 for that latte and that apple fritter. It's probably somewhere in that range.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I used a debit card to buy this.
Okay.
In other words, I have money in the bank, and I use this card. From my perspective, what happens is $7 disappears from my bank account.
Right. Well, that's very different. That's paying with your own cash.
Right. So Starbucks gets, do they get $7?
Yeah.
Or do they get $6.95?
I shouldn't say that so clearly. I don't really know whether there is some fee for collecting the money through the bank. I wouldn't be surprised if there is.
Debit cards and credit cards are similar.
Certainly there's a fee for use of credit cards.
They're both a little piece of plastic, right? And and when you swipe one of these cards, when I buy my latte, sometimes when you swipe it, it says, is this a debit card? Do you want to do debit or credit?
Right.
Right? You know, and if I say I want to do debit, it takes this money out of my bank account. But the Starbucks doesn't get the whole amount of money. They get most of the money.
Right.
But some of the money they lose to the company that runs the network that has the card swipers, I guess, Visa. Right? I have a debit card, but my debit card says Visa on it.
Well, I have to say, I don't know that in detail that much about the way the debit card piece of it works. In the credit card situation, it is quite clear that the companies that are accepting the cards as payment are paying a fee to the credit card company for each transaction.
Does it make a difference whether I press debit or credit when I buy that latte?
Well, it depends. Yeah, in terms of what the merchant recovers, I don't know. In terms of what you pay, if you press debit, it means you're paying out of your bank account.
Mm-hmm.
If you press credit, it means that it is going on your credit bill with the credit card company, and it is money that you still owe.
But if it's a debit card, I still get... I mean, the same thing still happens from my perspective. I don't think it makes any difference.
But you don't get a bill.
No, it still shows up coming out of my bank account.
Well, it comes... Yeah, but it's already out of your bank account.
Right.
With a credit card, it's not already out of your bank account. It's on credit.
I think the difference is the kind of card you use, maybe more than which button you push. That's what I'm saying. The debit card that I have allows me... I'll swipe it, and it'll say, do you want to use debit or credit?
You can't...
Either button I push...
But you can't with a credit card. You can't press debit
right.
and have it work.
That's right. With a credit card, you can't. And so if I have a credit card, let's say I pulled a different card out of my wallet, and I said, okay, I'm gonna gladly pay you Tuesday for a hamburger today. I'll take my latte and, I'll pay you at the end of the month, right?
But they get paid right away.
Yeah, Starbucks gets their money.
Right.
And then I owe the credit card company.
Right.
For that latte.
They pay the Starbucks.
Right.
And they pay for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you owe
them,
to pay it back. Well, it's nice of them, but they do it for a fee. I mean, one of the ways you'll encounter this is I don't know if you've ever used an American Express card, but there are many merchants that will not accept an American Express card.
The places I go, they don't take American Express.
Well, and there's a reason for that, and that is that the fee that American Express charges the merchant for... making good on what you've bought is higher than the fees that other credit card companies charge, and many merchants would rather not do that.
In other words, Starbucks, if I paid with my American Express card, if they allowed me to do that, they might not get $6.95 out of that $7 cup of coffee. They might get $6.50, right? And over time, it's not worth it to them.
It's more.
Right.
I don't know what the actual numbers are. But
I gotcha.
But they pay more. And I mean, this is what I've been told by merchants anyway.
Well, I didn't just buy a cup of coffee once last week.
Right.
I mean, I go to Starbucks a lot.
Right.
So I bought a lot of cups of coffee and a lot of apple fritters.
Right.
And over time, let's say in a month at $7 a day for that cup of coffee and that apple fritter, how many weekdays do you think we've got in a month? 20-some? Do the math. I mean, it gets up there, right?
23, something like that.
Yeah, okay, so 23. What's 23 times 7? 140?
150.
Yeah, let's call it $150.
Okay.
I'm not real good at math. but let's say it's $150 for ease of reference. Comes credit card day, I get a bill. Is the bill for $150? Or is the bill for a little more than $150?
No, the bill you have from your credit card is for the amount that you have charged.
So I get a $150
right.
bill from Visa.
Yes.
If I pay that bill, if I write a check for $150,
right.
Did I pay any more than $7 a day for my cup of coffee?
No. You have paid what you charge.
Right.
You know, when you charge it, you sign an authorization statement, a bill, saying this is how much I'm authorizing you to collect from my credit
card. That bill says something like minimum payment, and it's got a little box down at the bottom, and let's say it says $20.
Well, now you're talking about the credit card bill.
Yeah, the credit card bill.
Not the bill from, I was talking about the bill from Starbucks.
Right. Oh, no, that's what I was talking about, too. But now let's look at this other picture,
yes.
right? Okay, now I don't
minimum
write
payment,
a check for
right.
$150.
Right.
I write a check for $20.
Yes.
because the bill lets me do that. And, you know, I want to buy a new cowboy hat. So I need my cash. So I write a check for $20. What happens next month? Do I owe 130?
You're fine. You still owe the 130, but you also owe interest on the 130 that you didn't pay.
How much do you think I might owe?
Well, it depends on the amount of interest they're charging. Anywhere from 6 or 7% up to 30 or more.
Well, normal. I mean, I haven't had a credit card, actually, in a long time because I learned all this stuff in my 20s. So I mostly have a debit card that I use. But what I remember from having a credit card was it might be 20, 25%.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that $150, 25% of that would be what? Well, 20% would be $30. Right, and I paid $20 last month. So now I get the bill back. Maybe I suddenly owe $160 next month.
Mm-hmm.
How can that be? I paid $20.
Yeah,
but now I owe more than I did to begin with.
Well, that's the deal. That's the deal. That I mean, the deal is that if you pay off the card in full, when you get the statement, then you don't owe by the time that the payment is due. Then you don't owe any additional interest or fees. And all you pay is what you charged. If you do not pay it, the bank is continuing to extend you credit. But after that initial monthly payment, monthly bill period runs out, they start to charge interest on the credit they have extended to you. And so that gets added on the next bill. And the next bill, you'll see, will have interest added in.
Okay.
Whatever percentage the agreement requires.
Let's say this month I bought all my lattes on a credit card, and I went out and I bought two cowboy hats because they were just so nice. I couldn't resist. And I don't have $20 to pay them. So I just kind of let that bill sit there, and I'll pay them. And maybe next month I need a new pair of boots, right? You know, so I'll pay that either. What happens to my debt on down the road? And here I'm going to talk about what is Visa going to do with that? What is Bankius going to do with my what they're going to now consider a bad debt after I haven't paid it?
Yeah, but I mean, the first thing that happens is they'll continue to send you monthly statements. The monthly statements will include not only the interest on the amount that's due, but also late fees and possibly other charges because you have not paid the minimum amount by the date on which it was due. And this is all explained both in the statement and in the original agreement.
So the number gets bigger. What happens after I don't pay it for 6 months or a year?
Well, typically they will come after you for a while. But after, depending on the amount, but generally after about 6 months, the credit card company will regard it as, may well regard it as a bill that it doesn't make sense to keep working on. And so they'll make a decision, and this has to do, and it may be related to their, you know, how long you've had the card or their history with you, depending on how long it is. But at some point, and often 6 months is the cutoff, at some point the credit card company will say it's not worth our time to mess with this anymore. They will take it and they will bundle it with all of the other accounts that are in that situation, and they'll sell it to a company that buys these things to collect them.
So it is that moment in our broadcast where I remind you that you are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. And my guest today is Ed Whalen. We're talking about consumer advocacy issues. Ed, so let's say we get to that point where, you know, my many, many lattes and many apple fritters have been bundled up with a bunch of other consumers' bad debts, and they're sold. Then what happens?
Well, as far as the bank is concerned, they're done with it. They write it off. They move on.
But what about me? What about the consumer of the lattes and the apple fritters?
Well, there are places in the country where they are required to inform you that they have done this.
Okay.
Virginia is not such a place.
Virginia doesn't have to say we sold your...
Right.
Okay.
But really, from that point on, it's up to the company that has bought the debt to collect it, which... we call a debt buyer company.
Okay.
And there are many such companies in this country, in the United States, but there are 5 or 10 that are huge and that are everywhere.
Okay.
And So, and those are the ones I have experience with.
All right.
And basically, they'll do several things. Initially, they'll get in touch with you, send you a letter, or maybe give you a call or two or five or ten, try to get you to voluntarily pay the bill.
Right.
The letter will have certain information that is required by federal law.
Mm-hmm.
It will say, and they have to say this on the phone calls too, it will say, we are a debt collector, and that's the purpose of our contact with you. The first letter will advise you of your right to dispute the debt if you have any disagreement. There's no penalty if you don't, but it's an opportunity you have.
Now, why do they say they are a debt collector? What is a debt collector? Isn't Bankius a debt collector when I owe them a debt?
A debt collector under the federal law I'm talking about is defined as a company which is collecting debts that are owed to a different entity or that were originally owed to a different company.
All right. So Bankius is not a debt collector under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
That is correct. What we call an original creditor.
Okay.
They're the ones that originally loaned you the money.
So when Bankius sells it to the debt collection company, then the debt collection company is a debt collector under the Act.
Yes.
And they have to tell you that.
Yes.
And they have to tell you that you can dispute it.
Yes.
What happens if you say, I dispute it?
Well, then you have 30 days from the letter to tell them that. And you can tell them by telephone, but it's much better to do that in writing because you get more rights.
Mm-hmm.
And explains this in the letter. This is part of the language that the federal law requires, the Federal Collection Practices Act requires. And basically, if you send in a written dispute, then they are required to investigate and verify the fact that you owe this money, the fact that that this is the amount you owe, and generally check it out and
make
sure it's right.
How many people dispute these debts?
A very small number.
Why?
You have to ask them.
Because people don't understand that it's going to mean anything, maybe?
I think that's right. That the language, first of all, looks technical and legal. And some people may not understand it. Other people may not understand. One of the benefits is that until they have completed their investigation, they may not contact you again.
Right. So they got to stop making the many, many phone calls
call,
a day.
They cannot send you any more letters. First, they have to do the investigation and report to you on the result of their investigation.
All right.
That's the good news. The bad news is that the standards for the quality of an investigation they have to do are extremely low.
Well, some people figure I owe the debt, and so I'm not going to dispute it because I owe the debt.
Or people don't dispute it.
You're right. So if you send them a letter and you say, I dispute the debt, they have 30 days to do an investigation.
You have 30 days to send them that letter.
Oh, I'm sorry.
After you get the letter.
You have 30 days.
You have 30 days.
But once you send them the letter, how long do they have to do the investigation?
They have as long as they want. But until they complete the investigation and report back to you, they are prohibited from contacting you or taking any further action to collect the debt.
So I wonder if, debt collector has 50 bazillion accounts like this, if you send them a letter and say, I dispute the debt, how many people will never hear from debt collector again?
Well, most people will hear back. But there are cases where we've heard where the debt collector just basically never got back.
Okay.
And that was the end of that.
Right. Okay. So what does the response look like when debt collector gets back to you?
The ones I've seen, normally it's a letter that says we've looked into it and we've determined that you owed, this particular bank money on this credit card and this is the amount and we've decided that this is correct.
Okay.
And so it doesn't mean what looking into it means? It's an excellent question. It's a subject of much debate and litigation.
Okay.
Basically, it doesn't seem to mean much.
Okay.
But they've done something.
They've done something. Maybe they pulled up the spreadsheet on their computer that Banky has sent them to begin with and said you owe this amount.
A lot of times what they've done is to check and make sure that this is, in fact, the right name. This is, in fact, the right address under the information we got, this is in fact the right amount.
Well, that would be important, right?
It is important.
I don't want to get charged for someone else's apple fritter.
That's correct. That's correct. But it doesn't mean that they've investigated to see whether it is in fact your account.
What do you mean?
Well,
if they looked at the name, if they looked at it, why isn't that good enough?
Well, suppose the bank made a mistake in identifying you as the person whose account this was. They should check that.
Well, maybe if my name was Jane Smith.
Often they do not. Right. No, but, I mean, and if your name is Smith, then you have a whole other set of those kind of problems in all kinds of ways.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
But they're supposed to look into it and do something. Typically, they don't do that much.
There's a lot of fraud happening with credit cards and with online credit card numbers and things now, too. I mean, I remember a year or two ago getting a phone call from my office manager at work who asked me if I had rented the penthouse suite at some casino in Las Vegas the weekend before. And I was like,
if only.
No, you know, I wish. No. Right. So that probably happens, too. Is that something that can be caught there?
It could. And in your, you know, again, if you send in your dispute letter an explanation saying, I don't recognize this account, I don't owe it, and it's not me. That ought to trigger that kind of investigation. I mean, it's a whole category of problem which we call identity theft, where people take your identifying information, if they can get it, and open accounts in your name and do all kinds of things.
The debt collector does whatever they do to satisfy themselves that indeed I owe this money for these lattes.
Yes.
Or the debt collector probably doesn't even know it was for lattes. They just know that Bankius says I owe the money.
Right.
So then they do what? They send me a letter back and go, we've investigated and you owe the money.
Yes.
Then what happens?
Well, then the door is open again. And it's up to the debt collector what steps they want to take.
Okay.
The cases I deal with typically involve cases where they then bring a lawsuit.
Okay.
I mean, some debt collectors rely heavily on the letters and telephone calls, as many people have experienced. Some rely less heavily on that. But then they go, I guess I'll mention one thing about the telephone calls, which is that under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, the consumer also has the right to tell them to stop that, just to simply stop.
Mm-hmm.
If you write them a letter and say, do not call me or contact me anymore about this, they are required to comply with that and stop all telephone calls.
So the annoying people who are calling you 50 times a day, you just say, stop calling me.
Yes.
And they have to.
And if they continue to call you after they get that letter, that is a violation of this federal law and you can sue them.
Okay. All right.
So they are required to stop. Now, they're not required to stop trying to collect.
Right.
They're just required to stop calling you and writing
you
letters
on the phone
as a technique.
Right.
And, you know, if they want, then at that point, maybe they'll file a lawsuit, something like that.
Okay. So what does it look like when they file a lawsuit?
It's very common that they file lawsuits. Typically, they're in Virginia, in the General District Court, which is the lower jurisdiction amount court. Mm-hmm. They will file the paperwork with the court and file the lawsuit. They will usually include with their paperwork some documents about what the nature of the debt is and an affidavit from somebody saying under oath that that this money is owed, or looking like they're saying that. And
Who swears out the affidavit that you owe the money?
Typically, it is an employee of the debt buying company.
So it's not Bankius.
Right.
Okay. All right. Keep going.
There are cases where the bank will have an employee do it, but typically it's the employee of the debt buyer company.
Okay.
Who can say under oath, we got this stuff from the bank.
Right.
I've looked at it. It says that
he or she owes
$5,000. And so as far as we know, that's the amount that's owed.
Right.
I state this under oath.
Right.
So they'll file that with the court. Then the papers get served on you.
Mm-hmm. Deputy comes out.
Deputy comes to your place.
Knocks on the door.
They also are supposed to mail you a copy.
Mm-hmm.
And because the deputy, if you're not there, can just
stick it on the door.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes if they stick it on the door, you don't get it because something happens to it.
Right.
Excuse me. And you get it, and then you have in the General District Court, what it will tell you is that there is a date on which the case is scheduled to be heard, and that's called the return day. And the return day is simply a day for the court to look at the case and determine whether there is any disagreement about whether the money claimed is owed.
Okay.
If there is no disagreement, then a judgment will be entered for that amount. If there is a disagreement, then the case will be scheduled for a trial.
So we're going to take a break at this moment, and okay. We will come right back and talk about what happens in court.
Okay.
You're listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. If you'd like to participate in the program, it's 434-284-9470. And now, back to your host, Andre Hakes.
Welcome back to Straight Talk. I'm Andre Hakes. My guest today is Ed Whalen. We're talking about consumer advocacy issues. Ed, and we were just at the point where big debt collector has taken Bankius's debt, and now big debt collector has sued you.
Right.
So what happens when you go to court, or do you go to court?
Well, in the vast majority of cases, people do not go.
Why don't people go to court?
I think that's an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, maybe some of them owe the debt.
I assume that's because some of them don't disagree.
Right.
I think, many of them are not familiar with the court system. Mm-hmm. And are concerned about what may happen. Often these are people with financial problems, which is why they're behind, and they don't want to take a day off of work.
Right. That makes sense.
Go to court. Some people, I was talking with some folks this week about this, and it's a real question. Some people may believe that if they go to court, they're going to be ordered to pay the money then and there.
Right.
Which is not true. You'll often see at return day people going to the judge and saying, yes, I owe the money, but I'm sorry, I just can't pay it now. Mm-hmm. Can I work something out? And the judge will say, not my problem.
Right.
That's not what we do here today.
Right.
You're welcome to go and talk with them if you mm-hmm. want and try to work something out. But I'm not here to order you to do anything. I'm just here to either enter a judgment or schedule it for a trial.
Well, isn't that what a judgment is, an order that you pay them the money?
It works like that, but it is not an order that you pay them the money right now.
Okay.
It's not like you go to jail if you don't come up with the money out of your pocket right then. But I think there may be people who have that concern because they're not familiar with the system.
Right. They think I might get locked up.
Right.
Okay.
And there are some debt collectors who are willing to imply that.
So when the person from the debt collection agency
yes.
comes to court, do they just have one case? They just have your case?
Well, here, typically what happens is the debt collection agency, and they're not, they don't have their offices here in Charlottesville. There mm-hmm. is one, Portfolios Recovery is based in Norfolk,
mm-hmm.
They're in Virginia. They're one of the biggest in the country.
Okay.
But they're not in Charlottesville. So typically what they do is to hire a local Charlottesville lawyer who will go to the General District Court with a stack of files.
Mm-hmm.
With the paperwork related to the case, and just wait until the judge calls it. And then one by one, as the judge calls the case, that person will tell the judge whether it's been paid off or anything has been paid and mm-hmm. the person deserves some credit or not. And if not, ask for a judgment.
I've seen these dockets, and what it right. looks like is the General District Court sits there and says, Smith, and whoever the attorney is says, no payments.
Right.
And the judge says, judgment, $250.
Right.
Jones, right, $250 right. payment. Okay. Judgment for, right, and it just sort of goes through like that.
Exactly. It's very, assembly line kind of.
What happens if Smith shows up?
Well,
what happens if I come to court and go, that was not my latte?
When your name is called, you go up, and the judge will say to you, do you agree that you owe the money?
Mm-hmm.
If you say yes, mm-hmm. the judge will say, okay, I'm going to go ahead and enter judgment. And
right.
often people do that.
Right.
If you say, no, I don't agree, then the judge will say, okay, we will schedule it for a hearing.
Okay.
And he'll find a date that both sides agree to and put the case off for a hearing.
Okay. If I do that, if I go in, let's say it wasn't lattes and apple fritters. Let's say that somebody bought, pizza. I'm not a big pizza fan. Right. And I go, this is not my pizza debt. Right. I don't even like pizza. And I come to court and I say that. And the judge says, OK, well, you come back next month. Here's your court date. What happens then?
The court the judge also will let you know that he's not really interested in why you don't.
He doesn't want to know,
do you agree or not?
Oops. He doesn't want to know that I don't like pizza, especially pizza that has green peppers
on
it. This was not my, you know.
It's not the purpose of this initial day.
Okay, all right. So
do you agree or not? If you don't agree, then they schedule for a hearing down the road.
All right.
And then call the next case. And that's all they do.
So we're down the road now.
Okay.
It's a month later. We come back.
So then what happens? Typically what happens is the judge will require the debt collector company to file with the court what's called a bill of particulars, mm-hmm. which is basically a statement in detail of why they think they're owed the money.
Actually, I need to ask for that, don't I? That first day when I come in?
Well, it depends on the court and the judge.
It would be smart of me, would it not, to say...
Yes.
I would like a bill of particulars.
If the judge does not automatically do it, you should definitely.
Even though
ask
I don't really have any idea what that means, because I'm just somebody who likes latte.
And then you are required to file what's called a grounds of defense, which is your response.
Well, what is a bill of particulars? What is a grounds of defense? What do I do after I ask for this thing that I don't really know what I'm asking for?
Well, I would urge you to write down what the dates are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or actually, the in the courts I've been in, they will routinely write it down for you and give it to you when they're done scheduling the dates. But basically, the bill of particulars is a more detailed stuff. I mean, when the case is originally filed, the General District Court has a form, which is called a warrant in debt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a form that it's a one-page form that basically says, this is who we are, this is who you are, this is how much we're asking for and why.
Right.
But it doesn't give any details.
It doesn't say it's for pizza.
It does not say that, right.
Okay.
Actually, we were talking about people being concerned about arrest. The fact that it's called a warrant.
Ooh, sounds like you're going to be arrested.
Sounds
sure,
like,
an arrest
you
warrant.
You may be in trouble.
Sure.
But that's all it is.
Right.
It gives no details about... the nature of the claim or anything like that. As I said a minute ago, often the collector will attach to the warrant in debt other supporting documents that do give more information, but they're not required to do that.
Okay.
They are required to provide those documents if they want a default judgment. So it's easier if they do it that way. But the bill of particulars is supposed to state in detail why they think they're owed the money, and they often will include documents in support of that.
Because you bought 15 pizzas with green peppers and anchovies.
Actually, the bill of particulars never has that kind of detail.
No?
What it will say is we bought this debt from the bank.
Uh-huh.
It is now ours. You owe, $2,500 on this debt.
Okay.
And it hasn't been paid. And therefore, we ask for a judgment.
Well, that's not
amount.
A very particular bill of particulars. I mean, it still doesn't tell me why I owed the bank the money to begin with.
Right. Often the documents that are attached will include one or two relatively recent credit card statements.
Okay.
Excuse me. And those will have some information.
Okay.
Often one of them will be the statement where the bank wrote off the balance.
Uh-huh.
And it's just entered something saying... Now written off, and now it's not ours, and we don't, it's zero now.
Right.
And then there may be one other statement or two showing, maybe the last time you made any payments.
Mm-hmm.
But those statements will have at the top, as all statements do if you're behind, the previous balance.
Right.
It doesn't explain
what the previous balance was.
What the pieces were that the previous balance covered. And basically, the debt collector has no idea.
Okay. So then I write a grounds of defense. How am I supposed to defend this thing since I don't know what I'm being charged for?
Well, if you agree you owe the money, of course, then that's what you say, and you're done. If you don't agree that this is an amount that you owe, that's what you say.
Uh-huh.
And you say you want them to provide evidence showing that this is the amount you owe.
Uh-huh.
What you would also say is that, you have no idea whether it's true that they bought the debt.
Right.
Right, they didn't consult you, and you weren't there when they signed the deal.
Right,
to buy the debt, and they have to prove that.
Right,
that they bought it. How do you know?
Right,
if they cannot prove they bought the debt, then they haven't been able to prove that it's theirs,
mm-hmm.
that they are the ones that have a right to get a judgment, assuming that you owe the money.
All right.
So they have to. So you would say, say, I don't know if they bought the debt, but they should prove that.
Right.
And and I don't agree that this is the amount that I owe, or if it's the case, I don't owe anything, and there are people in that situation.
Right.
And in any case, ask for them to put on proof showing that you owe the money.
Okay. So I basically write a grounds of defense, and I say, if there's some specific reason why I think, no way this is me, right. like, I didn't have a card with
right.
this
and,
bank.
And I've had cases
or,
like that.
You know, I didn't make these charges because somebody scammed my credit card number.
Right.
Let's say I know that, right? I would say that in my grounds of defense. Otherwise, I'd say, you know, who are these people? I don't know who they are. I don't think I owe them any money. They need to prove it.
Right.
And it doesn't have to be a complicated pleading. It doesn't have to be 20 pages long and legalese with exhibits, right?
Right. I mean, that is correct.
Especially if I don't have a lawyer.
That is correct.
Just write a letter and send it in. It's called a, you can call it bill of particulars at the top, or you can call it grounds of defense.
Yes.
Mail
yes.
it in there. All right. So we get to court.
But I would certainly, I guess, you know, what I should also say is I think talking to a lawyer is a good idea.
Oh, I think so, too.
about this stuff. because it's a, you know, what happens in court is its own world.
Right.
Lawyers know that world. They know the language. They know what people say and what it means. Most other people do not.
So what happens if I go to court on that trial date?
Well, and here I have to say that I don't really know what happens with individuals
okay.
who are not represented by lawyers. I mean, the cases
right.
I know, I'm involved.
Well, let's say I went to you mm-hmm. and I said, you know, Mr. Whalen, I don't like pizza.
Right.
And I think this is pizza debt and I didn't
right.
buy this pizza.
Right.
You know, I agree. Let's say it's my credit card.
Right.
And I agree that, you know, this $500 worth of latte is mine, but this, you know, $500 worth of pizza isn't.
Although, like I say, that kind of detail is not...
I know, it's not on there, right?
It's not in there anywhere.
But I right. know, because I've seen my credit card statements, and I know I owed about $500 for latte, mm. right? But I didn't know $1,000,
well,
so
you're,
therefore...
you know more than
More than most people.
People,
right.
Well, I mean, you know, and again, by the time it gets to court, it's typically been a few years
right.
since the last time...
Oh, so I don't have a clue what this
and
is.
And people sort of vaguely remember some of it and that they owe something in many cases, but they don't know how much.
So I go to you and I go, right. Mr. Whalen, I don't know
right.
what this is. I don't have any idea if I owe it or not. Help
right.
me figure this out.
Right.
And I've already filed my grounds of defense and they filed their bill of particulars because I didn't get a lawyer very early. And guess
right.
what? You know, court's coming up, but now I'm here talking to you. Now, then what happens? What
well,
do you do?
I guess, again, that particular situation has never come up with me. I'm typically I'm involved from the return day on.
Okay. Well,
in the cases I'm involved in, I do the things that we've just been discussing
mm-hmm.
that the consumer would do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I appear. We get a trial date. I get their bill of particulars. I draft the grounds of defense and send it in. If we get that far.
Mm-hmm.
But basically what happens is they drop it.
Why would they do that? Why would they drop it?
Because they don't want to do a trial.
Explain that to me. You
well,
you owed this money,
right.
Or they think you owe this money, or they wouldn't have brought it. And, you know, now there's a lawyer involved.
Let me
Why
just
aren't
say,
they just going to show it to court?
Let me just say, just to fill this in, I mean, I have my own views about why they do it.
Okay.
But they have never called me to say, we're going to drop it and here's why.
Right.
They just do it. I have been doing these kinds of cases on a regular basis for over a dozen years.
Maybe it's because you're so
okay.
scary.
And there have been two that have gone to trial.
Oh, yeah?
Where they have not dropped it.
Okay.
In that time.
Well, what's your theory as to why they?
No, well, my theory. I mean, it's a. And let me just say, it's not just me.
Right.
The FTC has studied this industry and
it's
what it does.
Not because you're so scary.
The well, of course I'm. You know, no doubt they take me seriously
yeah.
when they see it's
oh,
me.
Yeah.
But I can't say that's all it is. but the and the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the CFPB, has also studied this. And one of the things they have concluded is that it is normal in these cases that the companies file these lawsuits with no intention of going to trial, that they do not have sufficient evidence to make their case, and they know that.
Okay.
And they file it without any intention of going to trial. You know, going to trial involves having a lawyer show up,
uh-huh.
Having witnesses show up, you know, they have to come up from Norfolk if it's portfolio. They don't want to do that.
Right.
They and then they have to put on evidence showing, you know, the basis for the amount they are claiming, and they don't have that. They don't know the basis for the amount they're claiming. They often don't even have the original contract.
Mm-hmm.
And so how are they going to prove what is owed? And the answer is they can't. And rather than deal with that and go through the time and expense and trouble, they simply drop it. And the reason is this is the business model. The business mm-hmm. model is they have a very large, they have thousands of these cases, of these mm-hmm. accounts that they're trying to collect. And the basic business model is you spend as little time as possible on each one. You spend as little money as possible on each one. You collect as much as you can on each one.
Mm-hmm.
And going to trial is not, in their view, efficient, and it doesn't get them anywhere anyway because they're going to lose. There's been some studies done here in Virginia, done by some students at UVA, where they've gone and looked at court records.
Mm-hmm.
One was done in Fairfax, and one was done involving half a dozen jurisdictions. And what they found was that something like depends on the numbers and how it works out, but somewhere between 60 and 80% of the cases resulted in default judgments. That is, people didn't come and they got the default, and that's what the company wants. A small additional number of cases are those where people came and simply said, yes, I agree, I owe the money.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got their judgment there. Of the rest that were scheduled for trial,
mm-hmm.
almost all were dropped. Almost all were dropped. And of those that were not dropped, all but a very, like, less than five resulted in judgments for them.
What about people who showed up to trial without a lawyer?
Well, see, that I really don't have a lot of information on that because I don't really know about that.
I wonder.
I assume that they do more in those cases, but I may be wrong about that. It's certainly worth trying.
They still have to hire the attorney to go down there and present it, and so that's going to cost them money. You are listening to 94.7 WPVC, and this is Straight Talk. I'm Andre Hakes. My guest is Ed Whalen. We're talking about consumer advocacy issues. So basically,
one other thing I'll mention is, like I said, this idea that they're suing without any intention to go to trial sounds strange and mm-hmm. weird and astonishing to people who are not familiar with this system.
Why would you do that?
For people who are familiar with this world of debt collection, this is normal. This is not controversial. This is understood and accepted. As I said, the federal agencies that have looked at it have concluded this. Reporters who have looked into it have concluded this. One reporter did some went to Atlanta and went to some courts and wrote a piece for a newspaper in New York where what he said was he had learned that there were magic words that you could utter that would get you out of having to pay the debt. And the magic words were, show me the evidence.
Oh, those are good words.
And if you say those words, that basically they'll go away.
It's better than
they'll
hocus
vanish.
Pocus. I like those magic words.
Yes. Well, and in the legal system, in the court system.
Well, they
system,
said, show me the money, so you can say, show me right, the evidence, right?
I mean, in the court system, the theory is you're filing a lawsuit because there's a dispute and you have evidence showing that you are entitled to what you're asking for. That's not what they're doing.
No.
And that's one of the reasons that, I mean, what I do typically is, after they drop the cases like that, I then file federal lawsuits against them under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act.
Ooh, that might be why you're so scary.
Well, maybe. We'll see. But and again, none of those cases have ever gone to trial. They've always settled them eventually.
Right.
Though not always early.
So you sue them on the basis that they filed the suit without an intention of going forward?
That's one of my claims. I make two claims. Mm-hmm. One is that the amount that they're suing for is incorrect. And then we're going to go after getting that information and you know, it is a violation of the law to sue somebody for an amount that they do not in fact owe.
Mm-hmm.
It is also a requirement for lawyers that they have an honest belief that the amount that is owed if they file a lawsuit.
Right. If you're going to file this thing, you better have some reason to think that might be wrong, but.
Then my other argument is that it is essentially an abuse of the court system to file mm-hmm. a lawsuit with no intention of going to trial. There are a number of cases that have acknowledged that those are violations of federal law. There are some cases that have said it's not, and that merely filing a lawsuit does not mean you have any obligation to go ahead and go to trial.
I only have a few minutes left,
yeah.
And I want to get into the other kind of cases you do, because I thought this was really interesting. Tell us about the car cases.
Well, people have called me with problems with cars. I do have a pending case that we discussed involving a car that was bought that was damaged by a flood in Houston, Texas.
Okay.
The case hasn't been resolved, so I only can say a few things about it. But basically, the issue was that the dealer told my client that the car was in good shape, was okay, clean, and needed no additional work, and was ready to roll.
Well, this case that you're talking about, it's my understanding that, and there are a number of these cases out there, that there's an entity that basically publishes on the internet, hey, here are, you know, we've got a selection of good, you know, decent cars. If you need a car within a budget, here's some decent cars,
right,
for folks who don't have a lot of money, right?
Right?
And they are kind of a middleman who brokers the sale, and it's seen. You basically rely on their representations, and then you enter into whatever credit terms, and then your car gets shipped to you.
Well, what's on the internet is more sort of advertising, mm-hmm, for the car. Then the client dealt directly with the dealer. Mm-hmm. This is a dealer in Houston, Texas, and the car arrived. She was comforted by the reassurances given by the dealer. She agreed to buy the car, borrowed the money to pay for it. The, mm-hmm, car arrived. She got into it, and it stank.
Why did it stink?
And it stank because it was had mold all over it, because it had been underwater apparently in a flood in Houston. The spring before she bought it.
So the dealer just neglected to mention that,
yes,
the car had sat underwater?
Yes. Or? The dealer did not mention that. In fact, the dealer took steps intentionally to hide that fact.
To conceal. Well, what were some of those steps?
One of them was that the rug, for example, particularly in the back seat, but not just in the back, the rug on the floor was very moldy and stank. And what the dealer did was to, he didn't remove the rug or replace it, which at least would be...
That would be a repair.
What he did was to take a clean rug and put it, and take the seats out and put the rug down on top of the moldy rug, but left the moldy rug there. So it looked nice.
Okay.
If you wanted to take a picture of it,
So if you showed it to somebody over the internet,
right,
it looked clean.
But once you got into it and sat down, the mold was still there and it still stank. The owner's manual in the glove compartment,
mm-hmm,
had mold on it and was half soggy. she discovered when she bought the car.
Oh, no.
So she called him and said it was clear that this was not the car she had been promised, mm-hmm, and she wanted to return it and get her money back.
Mm-hmm.
And they said no, that it was what is called an as-is sale. That is to say they had denied... they had not made any promises about the condition of the car, and therefore they had no obligation to...
Well, are they right? I mean, aren't they right? Why, if you are a person who actually spends thousands of dollars to buy a car that you haven't seen, why is that not your problem?
Well, first of all, let me say, I would, I think buying a car from Houston does have a question in it. It is common in sales that there is what is called an as-is agreement. That is, there's a document that says this is sold as-is with no warranties. There
caveat
was such a
document emptor.
In this.
Buyer beware.
Yes. But a car dealer cannot make you promises and assurances about the condition of the car,
mm-hmm,
and then at the same time say this is an as-is sale.
Okay.
Those are inconsistent. You can say... I'm not making you any promises.
Mm-hmm.
The car dealers are certainly permitted to do that. And,
mm-hmm,
then the buyer is on their own in terms of risk, taking the risk. But if the car dealer says this is a clean car with no problems and doesn't need any work, and then says, but I'm not making you any promises.
Right.
He didn't say, but I'm not making you any promises. He
right.
said that.
It's a clean car.
But then one of the documents was this as-is thing.
Right.
So you cannot do both of those.
I see.
And the dealer
what about
is bound.
Puffing. I mean, I understand, yes, the courts look at, there's fraud in which you say this car has never been underwater.
Right.
Right? And the car has been underwater. It's a material statement of fact, which is false.
Whether it had been underwater was not an issue when she was buying it.
Right, of course, because how would you know to ask that question?
They
you
discussed,
wouldn't. It would never occur to you, right? But that would be a direct absolute fraud, right? And then
yes.
there's, this is a nice car.
Right.
Well, that's your opinion.
Right.
It's a nice car. I mean, that's,
right.
you know, puffing. I mean, that's not actionable. So how do you drill into what is and isn't?
Courts have ruled that, that kind of general statement doesn't apply. But she specifically asked, I've seen this picture and it looks like there's stuff on the car. What about that? And the answer she got was, this car is clean.
There's stuff on the car. What did she see that looked like stuff?
Well, she looked. It looked like there were little dots of things. And she was worried about mold.
Uh-huh.
And she said, what about that? And the dealer said, that just has to do with the angle and the light, the way the picture was taken.
I see.
But again, she said specifically, the car is clean and it needs no work.
Clean and needs no work.
The problem being that it needed so much work that it didn't pass the Virginia inspection.
And she has never
been able to drive it.
Oh man!
So we're involved now.
Who is she paying for the car? Is it a dealer financed kind of?
It was financed by USAA, so she borrowed the money from them to get it, and it was through USAA that she learned about the existence of the dealer and the car in the first place.
Wait! How does USAA tie into this? How did USAA have anything to do with her learning about the existence of the dealer and the car?
Well, they are involved with a company called True Car, and they have a website. And you can go to that and see cars that they offer that are, I mean, it's not their cars, but that are being sold by dealers that they say are at better prices than you will find in many places. And these are cars worth looking into if you're looking for a car.
So the bank that's lending the money to buy these cars is advertising the cars.
That's what they did, yes.
Sort of in a slightly indirect kind of way.
Yes.
And when she borrowed the money from USAA to buy the car, did she know that USAA ran the True Car site?
Oh, yeah. No, it is known as a USAA True Car site. I mean, they're both on there. And USAA has a lot of information about...
and the car site says these are certified dealers and things like that, doesn't it?
It says that, and USAA is very clear on this, that they make no promises about the condition of the car. But it says that the dealers that they list are what they call certified dealers, and that these are trustworthy people that you can count on.
What does it mean when they say the dealer is certified? Certified by who?
By them.
By USAA?
Yes.
Who's going to loan you a bunch of money to buy the car?
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
But people, you know, have real confidence in
USAA. So she's still paying for this car?
She's still paying.
She's paying USAA for this car that she can't drive. That stinks.
But like I say,
won't pass inspection.
There is a law. There are lawsuits pending about this that we're trying to work out.
Right? Wow. Okay. Ed, I want to thank you for coming in today to talk about this.
Sure.
It's been my pleasure. It's been really neat having you on the show. I had about 15 other consumer law topics I wanted to talk to you about.
Well, maybe someday arbitration. That would be a good.
Ooh,
thing
to talk arbitration
about.
Was on my list. Oh yeah. Absolutely. Because that's how you get around this whole having to go to court thing now. So, yeah.
Now, some of them get around it, yes.
Yep. I agree. But I think we're out of time. Thank you so much. I appreciate the work you do, and I appreciate you coming to educate people about it today.
Glad to be here.
All right. This is Andre Hakes signing off for Straight Talk. Have a good weekend, y'all.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.